everyone, and welcome back. This is Poetry in Motion, and Sonny and I and the lovely TJ in the background, who you can't see, but we here before the show have had one of those lovely pre-show chats where we've gone, oh, we're supposed to be live on air. So here we are now. This is Poetry in Motion. I'm your host, Tony Lontis, and my co-host is the beautiful Sonny Singh, who I will introduce in one moment. Before we do that, just a reminder, if you're listening on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, or LinkedIn, please reach out and comment, like, subscribe to the channel, reach out, connect with Sonny about her writing process, her books, and her story. We encourage you to do that. If you need to watch a catch-up show, because this is the fourth in a series of shows, a quick reminder that you can watch them on YouTube at the YouTube Tony Lontis, or you can watch them on Binge Networks, Hero Go, Zondra Networks TV, Paz TV, and soon Everyday Women's Network TV. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Now, each week we do a special moment that acknowledges the important role that our Indigenous people play in the development of our cultural country's identity. So I want to respectfully acknowledge the people of the Yugambeh language region on the Gold Coast, Queensland, Australia, the traditional owners of the land on which we speak and broadcast, and pay my respects to the elders past and present and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders peoples here today. Now you get to chat with the beautiful Sonny, but before we do, Sonny Singh is a cross-cultural seeker of deep knowing. She writes stories of self-discovery to encourage people to accept themselves for who they are and live life on their own terms. Her tales are of her characters' definitive moments in life journeys, and this applies to both her poetry and her novel writing. And she uses her multicultural background infused into her stories and poems. So Sonny is of Indian descent. She was born in Mexico, raised in Colombia, currently resides in the United States, and is traveling Australia this little while. And when she's not writing, reading, traveling, she indulges in meditation, yoga, and aromatherapy. She has a Soul Seeker poetry collection, and today we get to talk about the launch of Lonely Dove, her novel released today, and we will talk all about Lonely Dove as we get into the show. Welcome back to the show, Sonny.
Thank you so much for having me.
How's the trip been going?
The trip is wonderful. I've had an amazing time. I've been, I think, in three different cities now in Western Australia. I'm currently in Perth and I'm loving it. It's beautiful. Plus the weather is spectacular. There isn't a single cloud in the sky. So it's incredible.
That's awesome. Because in Queensland, it's raining again.
Oh, gosh.
The Sunshine State has become the rainy state. Well, it has particularly for the last 18 months. So anyway, everything's looking beautiful and green. And because it's spring, all the deciduous trees have their leaves coming out. Everything's flowering. It's sneezy and wonderful despite the rain.
At least that's a good thing. Everything's
lovely. It is. Now, Sonny was hoping to have a copy of Lonely Dove in her hand so we could hold it up and show you.
The only thing I have is my Kindle, unfortunately.
And it's a lovely cover as well, Sonny. Before we get on talking about the book, I actually thought that we might talk about the cover and how you choose an image and how you choose the font that go with your book, because it's a very personal experience, because they're your words and you want the cover and the font to reflect the book and your writing, don't you?
You do. And with this one in particular, and I don't know how much you can see because of the background, but maybe you can see a little bit.
We can see, yeah.
The title is Lonely Dove, and then you kind of see a dove there when a, and a And
And a
women.
female form, yeah.
And so for the covers, we I mean, with the publisher I'm working with, Kohler Books, who are based out of Virginia in the United States, they asked for our input, and I had actually already put together a mock cover years ago, as I was thinking of the ideas of the book, just to sort of have something more tangible to work towards. And at that point, I had realized I really wanted to have the dove in the image. There's a lot of symbolism behind the dove, but also it appears in the book, not just the term lonely dove, but an actual physical dove. And at the end of the day, this, even though it's a love story, it is also one of self-discovery for the protagonist. And so, since it's a female protagonist, it was important for me
The
to have that
female
there.
imagery.
I mean, I didn't design the cover in the end, but I did have to give
The
either
ideas.
images that I liked or ideas for the designer to put together. And then, you know, we had different mock-ups of the cover come back, and you know, it actually went up to a poll. I sent it out to my social media to get people to vote on which cover they like best, and this is the one that came through.
Oh, that's
It
great.
won. Yeah.
That's great. Sony, let's just briefly talk about the significance of the dove. So it's in the title, it's in the book. What do doves mean to you, Sony?
Well, I mean, what is well known about the symbolism of the dove
Yes.
is peace and love.
Yes.
It represents a lot of goddesses of love. So it's the symbol for Aphrodite, for Venus. And so and because they are the deities that represent love, it's not just what you would call romantic love, it's also self-love.
Yes. We forget
Which is a
about
big
that,
part
don't we?
of the journey. I mean, the journey that my character takes in the book is one where she's seeking her soulmate. So she's looking for romantic love, but she also needs to learn self-love. And the deeper spiritual meaning of a dove is that it's that self journey, that journey that we take on to discover ourselves and to love and appreciate ourselves.
And that journey to self-love, from my experience, and I know that's the same for you, Sony, that journey to self-love can be really a lot more difficult. Like we all think that finding romantic love and soulmate love is difficult, but from my perspective, it's been the self-love and the gaining of self-love that's kind of been far more difficult.
It is. And the thing is, people, I mean, you know, you hear people say things like, in order for somebody to love you, you have to love yourself. But then when you start to break it down, you consider, well, what exactly does that mean? What does it mean to love yourself? And it's not just you look at yourself in the mirror and you think you're beautiful. You know, it's
No, it's
really
more than that.
accepting yourself for who you are, allowing yourself to be seen, to show all aspects of yourself. To honor your journey. And for instance, you know, I have the tagline, trust in your soul's destination. That's the essence of it in a way, because when you love yourself, you also honor your intuition, you honor your inner calling,
They're
you
linked, aren't
listen to
they?
yourself and you value that.
And inherently linked. You can't trust your intuition if you don't love yourself, because if you don't love yourself, you second guess what you think is the right way, or it just doesn't work. So they're linked together, aren't they?
They are very much linked. And, you know, when we were talking about the chakras last week, at the essence of the chakras is also, for instance, the journey that you take as you experience life, which starts with feeling safe and, you know, kind of creating. And eventually there's a portion of it that is love, but that love has to radiate from within. You know, we tend to think that you're looking for it outside, but really it comes from yourself. And when you are able to accept that, that's when your intuition actually starts sort of opening up, and you embrace it a lot more.
Sony, we need to point out that there's been a completely different process and a different publisher with Lonely Dove. And so I wanted to like reflect on the two experiences. So poetry writing is different, obviously, from novel or long form writing. And I wanted you today to reflect on those differences. So the audience might like to note that Lonely Dove was actually one of the first of your writings, and it was just that the poetry flowed and got delivered to the world quicker. So we're going to go back to Lonely Dove and talk about why it was longer and what the process and why it was different.
So Lonely Dove was something that I started working on in January of 2018. So it's been at this point 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And it's really how I started exploring my writing life, in the sense that I've always written in some way, shape, or form in whatever job or occupation I've had, whether it was something as simple as writing promotional material or training manuals. And prior to writing Lonely Dove, or in fact, at the time that I was writing Lonely Dove, I was a wellness coach, and I put out articles. I have several articles, in fact, published that are about wellness and aromatherapy and herbal use. And I realized that I loved the process so much of actually writing.
Yeah.
But what I really wanted to do was creative writing, not just non-fictional. And so I started sort of writing on the side, meaning I do my work. And then I started this novel, which was an idea that I'd had in my head for a long time. And so when I started writing it, at first, I didn't even know, do I have it in me to finish a novel? I didn't know, because I was used to writing short articles. And I sort of clandestinely was writing it. And eventually I realized I was spending more time writing my book than I was actually doing my work. Because I got really into it. But it really takes a lot of you, because, you know, when you think about a novel, like you think about an article, it's 800 to 1200 words. A novel, you know, for it to be considered a good length, has to be at least 80,000 words. And then you have to have that storyline continue throughout. There has to be consistency. It has to make sense. And so it's a lot more effort to write a novel. And I actually really didn't know if I was going to be able to complete it. And so once I completed it, that's when I started kind of looking for help and support and seeing, you know, is there value and worth in this? And it's been a long process of rewriting, editing. And the other thing I have to say is, you know, I do have a lot of degree certifications, but none of them are in writing. So that's something that I also to turn back and learn, which was part of the reason that it's taken this long to put together the novel versus the poetry that, you know, I started writing poetry essentially 2.5 years ago. And so by then I'd already been writing a novel. So I already had that practice of writing. But the poetry was a lot more fluid in the
and it
sense
flowed
that,
from you
yes.
versus the novel, where you had to concentrate and make sure that the characters moved along the path that you wanted them to, whereas the poetry just flowed and you just wrote it down.
Exactly. And it just happened the whole process, even printing it, and I think that's why the books came out faster or sooner than the novel, because it was something I didn't expect. It was something that I wasn't working towards. And things just started unfolding one after another, including how easy, in a way, it was to find the publisher, get the poetry published, and get them out into the world. I mean, it was just one thing after another that just fell into place.
Yes. Whereas the book has been longer. Now, I want you to reflect on the publishing process between the two.
So with the novel, it's a lot longer, in the sense that I was at one point trying to figure out, should I get an agent and try to get it traditionally published? Should I not? Should I try to look for a hybrid publisher? I definitely knew that I didn't have it in me to self-publish. Self-publish does require a lot of effort from the author. And I didn't want to go in that direction, but I didn't know,
There's
yeah,
so much
what
to
the best
learn,
seller
Sony.
was.
There's so much to
And
learn with books.
yeah, and you know, different publishers, whether you wanted what they call the Big Five, the Penguins, HarperCollins, those Simon & Schuster, like they're the big publishing houses. For them, you have to have an agent. You know, they don't take publishing deals unless it comes through an agent.
And then how
And
do
then
you find
there's,
an agent?
well, and that's the thing, you have to pitch. You go out there and you pitch, and I did that. I did a lot of pitching. I did video pitching. I did short pitching. And I think out of all of those, I had only five people who actually replied, because a lot of people will not even get back to you. And one of them who said, "I loved your story, but it's not for us." And then I got a whole series of rejections until after that, I thought, you know what, let me try and see if I can approach a smaller publishing house. And I narrowed it down to about, I think it was 15 or so. And Kohler Books were the ones who replied. And so I got that one done January of this year. So that's when I signed the publishing contract with them.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, so very different from the poet dream.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was thinking about it last night. It's just two completely different processes, and ways to publish, which actually gives you lots of credibility as a writer, having had that experience in the first place. Like just talking about the pitching experience, now that you've done it, when it comes to doing the next one, you might actually find a traditional publisher for your books or your poetry books because you've had that experience. And
Exactly. And I mean, Kohler is actually a hybrid publisher, and so they, for instance, will give you a publishing deal based on the number of sales. So they have it a different way because they're much smaller. You know, a larger publishing house is just able to give you a deal straightforward. But here with this one, it's based on sales. But yeah, it's been fascinating. And now that I know, because at the time that I was trying to get my novel out, I really had
You
no
just
clue.
don't know, do you? That's the other
I didn't
thing
have
for
any idea.
anyone.
I didn't know how it worked. I didn't know, you know, how do you frame your novel so that it's interesting, rewriting the first page because that matters a lot, making sure that you get
And I
grab the
must
attention
say,
immediately.
I'm into the book now, and I've read the first, well, more than the first page, obviously, because I couldn't stop reading it last night. I'm like, ooh! And I've just kept reading, and I can vouch that the first page of a novel gets you engaged. It has to be good.
It has to be good. And you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because that first page came together only for this version, in the sense that it wasn't the first page for a majority of the versions that I've had of this book.
Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that fascinating?
It, this one, this the opening of the book, or how it actually comes at this point. It started with that scene that the protagonist goes and meets somebody because she's getting visions and she wants to get explanations. But it started at the time that she walks into the restaurant to meet this guy, not like she's standing outside waiting, where essentially the book opens. Yeah, so that only came together at, I would say, probably maybe 6 or 7 months ago.
Amazing. And that's the thing that the audience needs to understand about writing. It may not actually be the way you think it's going to be, and you've kind of got to be open to suggestion, which leads me to the next question. All good writers talk about getting great help, be that book mentors, editors, frameworkers, whatever it is. Can you tell us about some of the help that you've had along the way for Lonely Dove?
And that's a beautiful question, because there have been so many people involved. I mean, writing is a solitary job, but at the same time, in
Correct.
order to get that writing out into the world, you need a
A
group of
lot of people.
people. And for me, for instance, with the first draft, after I finished and realized, okay, yes, I do have it in me to complete a novel, I relied at first on a friend just to say, can you just read this and say,
just tell me, I need something.
Yes. Do I have the skeleton
know,
on which
do
to
you,
put
Sony?
The muscle on?
You don't know, do you, Sony? Like
no.
When you first write a novel or a book, you don't know because you're too close to it, you know? And you
and the
need
thing
that
is, when you read other people's work, you have the ability to be critical, but when you read your own, you don't see it because you start kind of either getting used to it or, you know, you get more focus on how you're writing than the actual content of it. So it's harder for you to see it critically. But after she read it, she said, you know, she had a friend who's a freelance editor, and even though the editor, her editor friend focused, did nonfiction work, she still did me a favor just to say, you know, I need a professional, more of a professional eye to look at it. And so she helped me for a few months, but eventually I realized I really needed expertise on a fictional level. And so I started working. So I signed up for sort of a small group author coaching. And there was a group of about, I forget how many there were, but there, in fact, the lady is still based in Australia, Joanne Fedler, which is how eventually I met Karen, by the way. That's that's how the connection happened. So I took her courses, and the way that she did her coaching and mentoring is that she did it as a group sessions. And so she provided content and calls and that kind of thing. And so you would have to go back yourself and try to fill in the blanks and try to see your own work. But as we said, you know, it's hard when you're writing it to then say, have I done this effectively? Like, I can hear what she's saying, but now I need somebody to actually give me specific feedback on my book. And I worked with another coach who also had kind of a group session. She did provide more one-on-one coaching. In the end, the process for that and how she worked was too long for me. I stopped working with her. Had a mentor for a short while, for about 6 months, who also helped me to think more critically about the book. Once I realized that I had what I needed to actually complete a draft that I was happy showing somebody else, then it was time to look for a proper editor. And so I found him through an editor agency. And now what he was doing was two things, developmental editing and copyright editing. So developmental editing will look at the book critically to say things like, is the
structure.
Opening... Is it going to hook the reader in? Is there, you know, a flow, a story arc for the story? Is it consistent? If there are symbolisms that you use, are you using them throughout the book? In the right way? Do you open stories and then close them? You know, do you resolve everything? So they look at it in a very critical fashion. And
Which
the beautiful
good,
thing
though.
About that is that you then get a report, because you get a report that tells you chapter by chapter. And that's what he did for me, which was absolutely magical. And I think it was after that draft. No, it was not. I think it was after that draft that I started sending it out. Sending the manuscript out. Yeah. So quite a process. Oh, and I can say copyright editing, which he also did, is looking at grammar. Grammar to make sure everything, sentence structure and punctuation and all of those things are done.
And then
correctly.
You can actually have different types of editors as well.
You so can. And some people will only do developmental editing. Some people only do copyright editing. I mean, so it's not copyright, copy editing. So it depends. Some people will do both. But the funny thing is, even after you do that, the publisher still has you go through editing.
I know. And it's a painful process. Can I tell you that editing is not fun? It is really tedious. And by the time that you get to editing, you know that story like backwards. And you actually get to the point and you go, I thought I corrected that sentence to XYZ. And you kind of just go, but now it's this. Did I do that? Or did the editor do that? Like, it's a tough portion, but a necessary portion to get the book out to the world.
Yes. And the thing is also, like, once it got to Kohler Books, it went to the editor there. So she had a look at it. But, we continued essentially revising it up until the last moment. So the last version of the book got sent to the publishers on August 22nd. And I can get, like, even August 21st, I was rereading to make sure that everything was correct, that the logos appeared where they needed, because there's actually a symbol in the book that it appeared in the right place, that spelling was consistent, and we were catching errors. And I mean, I had beta readers and people looking at it who were still catching errors at the last minute. So
And
even when we try to get everything right, it still sort of takes an army of
I
people to get it
think
together.
that's part of the conversation is that it may not be perfect when it goes to print. It'll be as close to perfect as humanly possible. But I know authors who have had spelling mistakes in their final draft. And well, it's going to happen. And I just don't think it's the end of the world for people to see an occasional spelling mistake. I actually think that it's not a big deal. It's not gonna, the world's not gonna fall apart because there's a spelling mistake in your book. Because from getting it to publication, there's timelines. Like if you say that this book is gonna be available this date in September, then at the end of August, that's when you've got to hit the button and go publish. Like there's a whole sequence of things. So if there's a spelling mistake at the end of August, well, off it goes. But
So
I
be
haven't found any. There's been,
it.
I can't find any spelling mistakes, by the way, Sony. But
Thank
I'm not
you.
finished
Well,
yet.
and that's the thing. I mean, there's an army of people that have read it. I want to say at least 20 people have read the book at this stage before it even saw the light of day. And it's invariable that there will be something. But at the end of the day, even those 20 people are all human. So,
That's
you
right.
try to
That's
catch as much as you can, but
you're dealing with humans, so there's going to be. I want to just reflect quickly on that beta reading process and how you worked out to do that, number one, what the process was for you, and some of the sort of feedback you got from your beta readers.
So I had two rounds of it. The first round of beta readers I did a year and a half ago. And so that was, in fact, a draft that I had worked on before finding the final editor. And at that point, what I really was looking for was, is this something that somebody who is an avid reader would want to pick up and read? Like, would this story have enough to carry it, not necessarily marketable, but yes, is there an interest for this kind
Readable.
of story? Readable. And so at that point, I approached, I think in the end, it was six to seven people just saying, hey, would you be willing to read this and give me feedback? And I asked questions. I asked one, tell me whatever feedback you want to share, but also I'm wanting to make sure that this, and this are carried through. And I especially wanted people to tell me areas where I would probably go on for too long, like drag the narration for too long and they lost interest. And I said, if you're losing interest, tell me, because then that's something that I need to fix.
You can fix.
And that was valuable because it really kept me motivated. A lot of the feedback was very positive.
Good.
I tend to be a person who overwrites. Because I don't write to an outline, I just write. And so sometimes I have too much content that then I have to scale down. And I think it I overwrite because I'm trying to figure out the story. So I waffle on for way too long. And it was through them that I started identifying areas where I needed to just cut the story. And it's hard because
Oh, it
You
is
want to tell
really
the story,
hard.
but at the same time, it's your words, and you're thinking like, am I going to be effective enough? But I'll give you this as an example. The story right now is nearly 90,000 words long, so it's 89,000 something. When that version came out, it was 125,000 words. the one that I got the original beta readers from. So I had to cut.
I know, because what people might not realize is there's a certain number of words in certain books. So, just off the top of my head, historical novels, there's a certain word count that is perfect for the market for readers who like that genre of book. Same thing for lots of other things. And so you actually, as a writer, have to write to a word count or around about a word count. And that's
Yes,
really tricky.
it is. And for instance, my book is literary fiction. Usually literary fiction novels are between 80,000 to 100, 110,000 max, but that's now looking at a very thick book. Whereas fantasy, it probably starts at 110,000 because,
And
fantasy, you
goes
have to
bigger.
do world building and you have to do a lot of other things that, for a literary fiction, you don't actually have to get into. So they don't tend to be as long. But yeah, I mean, I would never have been able to present a literary fiction at 125,000 words and have gotten it accepted. They would have
That's a
said,
lot of
no,
words,
go through
isn't
several other rounds of editing.
it? That's a lot of words. A lot of words.
It is.
Sony, did you have trouble finding beta readers, or did you, like, a lot of people love to do that, and it's a wonderful thing for other human beings to gift an author a beta read of their fledgling novel, isn't it?
I only had about two people who either declined or didn't get back to me. The rest were very, they were responsive, and I think
Good.
I either had people who read avidly and so they were genuinely just interested in the book, or people who are writers themselves, and so a writer understands.
Yes,
A fellow writer understands what another writer is,
and
even if it's in a
that's
different
always a good
genre.
thing. That's
So no,
always a
I didn't necessarily struggle, but I did reach out to people who I knew would be interested in reading, or they would, they would just because they were fellow writers. And when I did the second round of beta readers, then it was only purely writers. I
good.
didn't go to readers.
Yeah. And whilst you said that their feedback was mostly positive, I'm sure that there was some negative feedback in there somewhere. That's hard to deal with, isn't it? So,
It is, but
some of
it's
it's
also a
really
learning
good,
process.
but yes.
Now, say for instance, one of the feedbacks that I had at the beginning was that just so many portions of it that I needed to cut. But it was also a lesson in it for me to realize what my style of writing was and acknowledge it and accept that I just overwrite. And then in that process of editing, that's when things get cut off. But also a learning, for instance, a lot of the dialogue. I didn't know how to di write dialogue. I had to take courses on writing dialogue, read books. But one of the feedback that I got told was, your writing doesn't sound realistic. Yet, because it was a beta reader, they didn't have an expertise to be able to turn back and
Tell
say,
you.
this is how you fix it. They just knew it's a problem. So then I had to turn around and say, okay, well, how do I fix this? And that's another reason why you need professional support, because that's when they look at it and they can give you that type of feedback.
Sonny, when you're talking about dialogue writing, it's not just your characters speaking words, it's also what's going on in their mind. That's dialogue as well. And there's two different
Absolutely.
ways. There's different ways of writing that so that the reader understands that this is what's happening in their mind. This is the dialogue in their mind. This is the spoken dialogue or the dialogue between two people.
It is. And the thing with dialogue also is that it has to have a purpose. You can't just say hi and the other person says hi back because that's dull and it doesn't really move the story forward. The dialogue actually has to help you
Understand.
tell another aspect of the story or show dynamic between two people. Or as you said, inner dialogue versus outer dialogue. Sometimes that in and of itself is really interesting. What is a character actually saying versus what they're thinking and holding back? That tells you something about the story. And so it's a very tricky thing because you also have to be really, really familiar with your characters. Like you have to get to know them really well to understand how they would respond to a situation or, why they would hold something back or why they would open their heart in a particular area of the story to be able to build that forward, or build a bond with another character, and why that one character versus the other one. So you really have to know
Yes,
your
yes.
characters.
And I know we've talked about this before, Sony, but sometimes in your writing and character, you might have a number of different endings or scenarios that they might go through. And it's not until you're actually in and writing the story that you'll take them on a certain path versus another path. Whereas I know writers who actually plan out their whole novel, what the character's going to do, where they're going to go, what's going to happen to them, and how the ending is. But for a lot of us, we're more I intuitive writers. So we think, I've got a general idea of this character, who they are, what their personality is like, and a couple of elements of what their journey's going to look like, and the rest will come to me.
And in the industry, that's known as a plotter versus a pantser.
Yes.
So the plotter will know, they know the story before they begin writing. And in
Yes.
fact, they need to know the story in order to start
That's
writing. Otherwise, they
right.
can't.
That's part of their
Whereas,
process.
yeah, whereas as I, I guess you and I are both pantsers in the
Yes.
sense that we just kind of
You
fly
just
off the seat of
know.
our pants. We let the story direct where we're going. And so a
Yeah.
lot of times, it isn't until I've completed a draft that I know at least more or less where I want it to end. But even that will change
Yeah.
as either the drafts evolve or my character evolves, or after as
Or you
the
get some
more I get
feedback
to know the
or
person. And it's
yeah.
funny that you think of your characters as people, but they are.
Well,
In real
they
life, they're
are.
people.
They are, and in your mind, they're people as well. In your mind, they often relate to a particular friend's characteristic or a particular relative's characteristic, or you borrow elements of real humans to go into fictional characters. It couldn't be any other way, could it?
No, and because ultimately you're right from your experience. So there, even in the villain, even in the most awful person, there's even an aspect of yourself that goes in there because it's still the world through your eyes. And even though
Yes.
you're trying to bring somebody else to life, it's still your perspective of that somebody.
Yeah.
And so, yes, and it's inevitable in a sense for you to not draw from your world. Like you have to draw from your world in
You do.
order to be able to
'Cause
bring
that's
this
your
to life.
experience, and that's what you want to bring to life for the writer. Sorry, for the reader rather, because the reader hasn't No two humans have had the same life experience, and so for a reader, they want to understand other life or fictional experiences to give them depth to their own life.
Exactly. And the thing also is that even when you're trying to write somebody who is not you, like you're trying to, you create a character that's based on somebody that you experience, a lot of times it's not just one other person, it's a
That's right.
series
It's
of
a
people that come
yep.
together to
Yeah.
make, the one character that you're putting forth.
Absolutely. Sony, I want to get you to read from Lonely Dove today for the audience. Can you do that for us now?
I can definitely. And so I obviously wish that I had the physical book, but I don't. We'll have to hopefully leave that for another show. Maybe I'll have it
Yeah,
physically by
I was
then.
just going to say, I'm sure you'll have it before the next shows, and we will hold it up then as well.
Yes. And so I also, before reading it, I just want to say that a lot of the story is based on visions that the protagonist Angie gets. And so this particular portion that I'm going to start reading is in chapter 13. If anybody does have the book in front of them, it's page 17. And it says, "She stood on the platform waiting for a train. The man standing on the opposite platform seemed familiar, but she couldn't get a good look. His face was hidden behind a hoodie, and he peered down at a book in his hands. She tried to call out to him. When she opened her mouth, there was no sound. She tried to clear her throat. Even that didn't make a sound. She grasped at her throat, wondering what had happened to her voice. A train whistled in the distance. She raised her hand to get his attention. He didn't look up. He still didn't notice when she waved. Her hands motioned ever more fervently as she jumped up and down, but to no avail. The train pulled into the platform. He got on the train and took a seat without glancing at her. As the train chugged away, a pair of dark eyes loomed into sight, blocking her view. A hairless, wrinkled face spoke one word, exorcismo. Angie sat with a jolt and opened her eyes. As she focused on the evening sky and the leaves overhead, she realized she was sitting on a bench in the Parque del Retiro alone. Angie had gotten a vision, again, and she had gone back to the Parque del Retiro for a walk. She'd had several long work days, and Josh had called her for a second time to bug her about the peace on dreams. He hadn't been so insistent before, but then again, she hadn't been so resistant to discuss what she was working on. Angie needed her head to be screwed back onto her body and thought a short meditation would help. It had worked until she got the vision with the taunting face of the Romani woman. Angie was covered in cold sweat. The first time Angie got a vision was the morning of January 26th, and it had come to her in a similar way as it had that afternoon. Instead of lying on a park bench, she'd lain on a rock in Central Park. When she went to her rock in New York, she got a sense of peace, and she tried to recreate the same feeling again that day in the Parque del Retiro, but it hadn't worked. Angie wondered if her visions were hypnagogic. The visions were vivid, almost real, which was how Danny described his dreams. Danny told her he entered them easily. He lay still, cleared his mind, and set the intention to go in a hypnagogic state. After a few deep breaths, he found himself in a semi-conscious dream. On the other hand, Angie didn't intend to enter anything other than her calmness. She had meditated, and without her awareness, the vision had appeared. She didn't have to try. The first vision had left her feeling elated. She wished it was real. When her mystery soulmate had whispered, "My lonely dove," a surge had coursed through her. The connection to the man in her dream was unlike any she'd felt before. She had wanted to stay with him. She didn't care that she hadn't been able to see his face. There was something about him that had felt familiar. Most of all, she had felt love. Despite the weight of her 41 years, the vision had made her feel she might still have a chance. It had awakened a hope in her that she hadn't felt in a long time. She wondered if it was a sign, a confirmation that she was destined to find her soulmate.
Doesn't that just make you want to pick up the book and find out what happens? It's really good, Sony. I know I keep it's open on the side of my computer, and I have to keep minimizing it so I don't so I keep working and not reading the book. Oh, which is good.
I'm grateful it's good. To hear that.
I'm curious how you came up with the name Angelae.
Anjali. So Anjali, funny, I have a cousin who has that name. And, you know, it's something that I've carried with me for a long time. And so in my mind, I thought if I ever have a character, I want to name her Anjali. It's Anjali, but it's hard to pronounce in Hindi, I guess. But I also wanted to have a name that was easier to kind of condense. And so I thought Angie, you know, Angie
is
pretty universal.
Yes.
Angie also sounds like angel.
Yes.
And so I
was going to ask you about that. With that. there's a lot of spiritual connotations and connections. So the dove and goddess and love and soulmate and the name and everything. Did you realize that as you were writing, or did it only become apparent when the novel was done?
Some of it was when I was writing. So some of it was intentional right from the beginning, including the choice of the names.
Yeah.
The dove had come to me before, but when I looked up the spiritual meaning of a dove beyond, you know, meaning peace, it blew me away. And that's when I thought, oh, that's definitely staying. Because at certain points, I was considering retitling the book and having it be called something else. And in fact, that's when I started looking at the symbolism of the dove. And then I realized, oh, no, I have to, it's become even more significant. There were certain things, like there's also, if people are into it, they'll pick up on it. There's a lot of numerology. And so there's timing.
I
and
thought
so. People
so.
Read it. They will understand if they're not into it. They just think, oh, whatever, it's the time.
Which is
and so those are deliberate. Those I put in beforehand. But some of the other ones just came about after the fact. So there's also a particular crystals that are I mentioned throughout the book. Those came in afterwards. That essentially the story had been set, and then I wanted to add a little bit more depth to it, and so I started adding them in there. And one character in particular, not Angie herself, but another one, uses a lot of crystals. And so again, if you pay attention to the crystal and you know the significance of it and what happens in the story, there's a link.
Oh, that's awesome. That's fantastic.
But if you don't, it doesn't matter. You know, it's not something that's going to hold you back from the story.
Now, I asked you this the other day when we were chatting, but there are more novels, aren't there, as well as poetry books. But because we're speaking about novels, there's more novels, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, so I am currently working on a second draft of a novel. And, you know, I'm at that stage where I've written so much.
Yes.
I finished the book. And so now I'm trying to figure out what story am I trying to tell? I know who the protagonist is. I know that she starts in a particular point in her life. Mm-hmm. And I know how I want her to be in terms of character development at the end, but I haven't necessarily figured out the entire trajectory. So now that I'm working on the second draft, it's essentially quite a lot of rewriting, and I've had to cut up the chapters and rework them because I also was doing a timeline that had a lot of flashbacks, which Lonely Dove does. I mean, Lonely Dove isn't, you know, a sequential book. It has a lot of
flashbacks.
Back and forth and on the timeline. But this one, I've rewritten it now so that it has a continuous timeline. So yes, I am in the process of the second draft of a book. Which at the moment I've called The Box, but I'm 100% sure I will change that title. Lonely Dove, the title came right
and
from
it's
the beginning.
Stayed. Yes, Lonely Dove, that was the title. That's what it was going to stay at, and it hasn't sort of moved. And it now makes sense to me as I'm reading the book as well. So your family, now that Lonely Dove is out there in the world, how proud are Mum and Dad?
Oh, they're extremely proud. They're so proud. And it's beautiful, actually, because in a lot of the career choices that I've had in the past, well, I should clarify this. My mother has always been supportive. It doesn't matter what I wanted to do in life. I think the only time she was disappointed was when I said to her as a child that I wanted to work as a cashier. And then she said, you might want to aspire for more, but, you know. So she's always been very supportive. My father has been a little bit more resistant.
Yeah, because they worry about
career choices.
Yeah.
But once I embraced writing, he fully embraced it with me. So it's been really, really wonderful. And my mother is a big reader. So she was very excited. My father is not a reader in the least.
Yeah.
And so he very proudly says that the first book he picked up and read cover to cover without stopping was Embody, which is my poetry book. And he's never in his life read a novel, but he started reading Lonely Dove. So he's reading it alongside you, for instance. Like he's just started to read.
That's awesome.
Whereas my mom is done reading it.
Of course. Oh, that's wonderful to hear, Sonia, because you do need support on the writing journey because, as you say, you write and it's a solo practice. There's not a lot of time for interaction except when you're editing or doing the other elements. Mm-hmm. But when you're just writing either poetry or your novel, it's a solitary thing. You're there in the writing space 100% and it's just you. Just you and your thoughts.
Yes. And it's beautiful to have my parents embrace it wholeheartedly. And it was funny because at one point I was debating, should I really do this or should I not do this? And my father was the one who said to me, you should do what makes you happy. Like
you're
you should
happy.
Do what makes your heart sing. And so to have him reinforce that of all people was particularly significant.
Fantastic. Now, before we run out of time, something else that we talked about this week was the fact that you're in early production of the audio versions of the poetry books, yeah?
Yes, they're on
So, what that means, audience, is that you will eventually have access to the paperback, the hard copy, the audio version, and the ebook for the poetry,
Yes,
which
with
is
Lonely Dove.
no. Yeah.
Yeah. With Lonely Dove, I don't know if there will be an audio
Yes.
option. Right now, there is the ebook, the hardcover, and
Yes.
the paperback,
And the
but
paperback.
yeah, we shall see. But
And
the poetry books have been recorded and it's my voice.
fantastic. Because there's nothing quite as lovely as hearing. I'm an avid audiobook fan, and I know from my perspective, when the author narrates her own work, it's extra special from my perspective. And I find it a little disconcerting when the author doesn't narrate their work, they use someone else. It kind of disengages me almost because there's not the same, I guess it's a spiritual energy connection. So when you read your own works, there's a spiritual energy connection between the book and your words and the listener in the audio series. And I think that's powerful. And I think people are going to love hearing you speak your poetry. I think that's just so much to be applauded, Sonny. Well done. Well done.
Thank
Now,
you.
before we run out
Yeah.
of time, we also want to let you know that coming up, there will be a special on Lonely Dove where you'll be able to buy it for 99 cents. And we will keep the show notes updated to reflect that. Now, mind you can still buy the book in any of its hardcover, pardon me, paperback or ebook right now, but Sony's going to do a little special and drop it to 99 cents, and we'll make sure that we keep you abreast of that in the coming weeks. Sony will let us know when that's happening. We were hoping that it would happen today, but technology in retrograde is challenging. That's all I'm going to say
It
about that.
is. It will come, and when it does, it'll come for a week, so it'll be available for a
A
week at that low
great
price. But
opportunity to
yes.
buy in that week, although I couldn't wait for that, so I've just got mine already. Sony, would you like to tell the audience what book we're going to be talking about next week?
We are going to be talking about book two in the poetry collection and the Soul Seeker collection, and it's called Embrace. So it'll be,
Yay!
yes, an evolution in the journey.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm looking forward to our chat again next week. For those of you watching and listening today, please don't forget to log in and listen next week when we talk about the second in Sony's beautiful poetry series. And don't forget that her books are available everywhere. I'm talking Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Booktopia. You can get them directly from her website. You can get them from the publisher's website. And wherever you see this interview, we'll see connections to Sony and her website, how you can connect and chat with her. And I encourage you to do that. And also where you can buy all of her books. Sonny, thank you so much for joining me again this week. I can't wait till next week.
Yes, thank you for having me.
All right, wonderful online audience. That's your lot for this week. We'll be back next week with another episode of Poetry in Motion with the beautiful Sonny Singh, and we'll be talking the second in her series of poetry books. Bye for now.